was also, you know, that was a very open, inclusive place to party. And, you know, people were always interested. And I photographed that as well. I don't know if I mentioned, like, it wasn't just people there weren't just gay people as well. You know, there were people that were very gay positive, I suppose, right? Mm-hmm. Like, but, you know, club people. Anybody that probably didn't fit into, let's say, you know, the straight party scene, or maybe wanted to be part of a gay scene that was more inclusive, you know,
yeah.
That, you know, because there were like lesbians and gay men and as I said, like, you know, I wouldn't really classify them as straight, but you know what I mean, you know, like club people. Kind of almost like New York style club people, which is what Nicholas was going for, because he felt like, you know, I think that you know, I don't want to speak for him, but from what I've read, he stated that you know, he felt like Montreal needed something like, you know, like he had experienced in New York, and so he wanted to bring that to Montreal.
On this night, we're having a party, and it's a great time, and usually. Usually, we Nicholas back in the day, and people who did bars, gay bars, would always have a lookout for the cops. And most of the time, the cops would show up. If you were doing like an after-hours party, get rid of the cash. The police would come and do the rounds, and just close the place down. But on that night, it got violent. They were aggressive. They didn't have badges. And they were provoking.
So in terms of what set this apart, you would say the violence is what set this apart from a lot of the other raids that were happening?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the big difference is that there was visuals. Hmm. Somebody was there with a camera. Otherwise, if Linda Dawn Hammond hadn't been there, there would have been no proof. It would have been our word against theirs. And it would have been just another typical hateful, violent, oppressive police raid on a disenfranchised community. And the difference was, many young people were in school, in university. We had become media savvy. We were in the midst of the AIDS crisis, so we were mobilizing. We grew up, some of us, not believing that queerness was something to be ashamed of, but something that's part of our integrity. Is that the word in English? But part of ourselves. And so I don't think the police understood what they were provoking that night. I think they just thought that, you know, push a few people around, you know, bring a couple of people into holding cells, give people fines, you know, abuse people verbally, physically. And they probably thought, night as usual and get away with it. And that night, they happened to pick on the wrong kids. The photos capturing the violence.
Right.
Capturing what these men and women in uniform were doing to our community when we weren't harming anyone. Mm-hmm. We were having a party. No one was killed. No one was injured. And they came in and decided that they were going to be abusive. And they, like I said, they picked on the wrong people that night. And we mobilized.
All right. So, let's see. I was invited to attend a party by Nicholas Jenkins, who was the person who organized Sex Garage Party. And he used to have parties in Montreal, which always had really interesting names like Candy Bar and Sex Garage. And he knew that I was interested in photographing just gay and punk subcultures and, you know, being part of that scene myself. And mm-hmm. So he'd invited me to come and photograph it. I actually showed up probably a bit late. The party started at around 11:30, and I showed up half the night, maybe around 1 o'clock in the morning, with some friends. We'd been at another club, and we showed up, and nothing particularly different was happening at that party. It was, you know, definitely no reason for the police to be called. There were some rumors afterwards that the police had claimed that Nicholas himself had asked for the police to come because the party was out of hand, but this was all untrue. It was in a warehouse district, and there weren't any neighbors, so there hadn't been any noise complaints either.
Right.
Sorry, my throat is still going. Anyway, at one point of the evening, I've been photographing just people dancing and partying and things like that. And at one point in the evening, suddenly we were told that the police had been there, and they told everyone to leave, except that nobody saw the police. And we were kind of questioning whether that was even true because, you know, there'd been performances earlier that night, and so some people were even suggesting maybe it was just a performance and this, you know, these weren't real police. But then another rumor started to circulate that a man had been beaten up between the cars in front. He had tried to return to the loft space to retrieve his coat. His name is Bruce Buck, and he had been taken between the cars by the police and beaten really badly and then arrested as well. And some friends of mine had witnessed this from a loft space. And so when we finally realized, yes, we have to leave, the lights came on and people started to exit through the door. We already knew something had gone on, that the police had injured someone. And then we were faced with maybe 30 or 40 police in front of the doors, which was really quite a surprise. It was quite excessive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, we didn't quite understand why they were there because, you know, there had been no upsets or anything in the party and, you know. People at the party who had exited decided that this was likely a homophobic reaction on the part of the police, and that was kind of verified when they started saying things to certain people in the group, like you know, stroking their matraque and saying, "I bet you like this, and you want this," you know, things like this, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, there was some sexual connotations behind their, behind this attack, I suppose. Mm-hmm. At this point, they were just, you know, kind of just taunting us, and people responded in like, people weren't taking it, and they just sort of stood there and basically said, "What's your problem?" And we're proud to be gay, and you know, the police at this point still had on their identification, and they didn't respond very well to two men in the group who basically mooned them, like showed their asses to the cops. And that seemed to really trigger a very bizarre reaction, because they started getting a bit more organized and they kind of conferred with each other and they formed more of a, like a little kind of a battalion kind of assault on us. And they started moving us towards like OSHA Chair and Beaver Hall Hill, away from the warehouse space. And they'd also, we noticed, they'd arranged their vehicles, the police vehicles kind of block certain exits, so you couldn't get to your cars or your bicycles if they were in one area of the street. Mm-hmm. You know, they kind of were trying to, I guess now they call it kettling, but there wasn't that term in those days, but they were basically trying to push us towards the area they wanted us to go to, which was the hill, you know. Then they started removing their identification badges in front of us, and that was chilling, because as soon as they did that, you knew that whatever it was that they had in mind for us wasn't actually legal, because I don't believe that you remove your identification badges, you know, if you're planning on, you know. Yeah, so that was the big indication, really, that things were going down, that were not going to be very pleasant for us. Yeah. And it just actually made people even more angry, you know, like in the group. And people didn't move because they thought, well, what is this? We have a right to be here, you know. And the police suddenly gave, they had certain police officers were still wearing their badges, and those were the ones I suppose were in charge. And one of them even had a megaphone and was directing the other ones. And they just suddenly charged at us and started beating people. And they were, I don't even know how many police were there, because they were all over the place. I mean, they probably surrounded us, you know, without us realizing. And they were in the parking lots, and they were chasing people across parking lots. I was on the hill. I had already shot like two rolls of film earlier, like in the party and at the previous place that I'd been, partying at. I handed over my first two rolls of film to a friend of mine, Daryl, who had volunteered to do this. He was on a bicycle, and he said he would stay in the vicinity, and if I needed him, he would rescue my camera, right? Because we knew that the police would most likely be after it. Because I was the only photographer there, as far as I knew. I didn't see anyone else at the time, and the police, of course, had been watching me, because every time I photographed them, my flash would go off and it would indicate my position, mm-hmm. you know? They started pushing us up the hill, and,
right.
You know, at this point, fortunately, I had already given away two rolls of film, right, to okay. my friend Daryl on the bicycle. And, I was wondering to myself at that point why they hadn't taken me down, because they were starting to grab people. And, you know, and obviously I knew they were going to be after the photographs. They had been staring at me when I'd been shooting them, and, you know, and they were obviously angry about it. But I think that I do believe that what they thought was, we can take her at any point. So might as well let her shoot. And then we'll have pictures inside the party as well, right? Because I think they used to use things like that to identify people who would frequent gay bars and, you know, just, you know, and after hours places. So, you know, that would have been of value to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't going to let them have it. Absolutely not. So, anyway, so we'd already protected two rolls, and then when they started, I was photographing the shot, probably my most famous one, of Wendy. That was the one that was in both of the newspapers, Wendy Stevens, and she was trying to leave, and they had tripped her, and she had fallen on her face, and she told me at the time, that they had whispered in her ear, get up, run. And, you know, and she had tried to scramble up, but they had taken their matraque, the sticks, and they had tripped her again before she had a chance to catch herself. And so she'd fallen on her face repeatedly. So that's how her face got so, you know, bashed up from falling on the ground. And I thought that was a particularly sadistic, mm-hmm. you know, this account. Anyway, so I was photographing her, and then they sort of jumped on one man that they'd gotten hold of, and they were in a big pileup. And I was standing only a few feet away because I had a wide-angle lens, and you know, with my dying flash, my flash at that point, the batteries had been dying. It made it very difficult to photograph, so I had to keep waiting for them to recharge. Anyway, I was photographing this guy in a pileup, and there was a couple of other women that I knew. One of them was on her knees with a stick at her head, and the other one was, standing there, and the police were confronting her, and they looked really, had the strangest expression. They almost looked afraid, maybe the reaction from the police was also that they were a little bit intimidated or fearful of the people that they were attacking too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and there was, and in the corner of that photograph, which always gets cut out by the media because they think it's not of any value, is on the very far left side is a man like another cop with a stick, and he's looking at me with this opportunistic look on his face.
Oh, yeah.
I only realized afterwards because that always gets cropped out. But when I looked at the entire negative, I thought to myself, well, he was very close to me, and somebody came up behind me just after I shot that, and they knocked my legs out from behind. You know, like they hit my knees, so I fell forward, and I didn't even realize I'd been hit because it was dark, and you know, and I was concentrating on shooting and. You know, I didn't realize until somebody, witnesses told me afterwards. I thought I cut out, I tripped, but then I thought, well, what did I trip on? I don't remember tripping, you know? Why am I falling? I was just basically, why am I falling? And and then somebody also told me that they hit me across my hands, like around the chest area where I had my camera. And, again, I didn't even notice that. If people hadn't told me, I don't think I would have realized exactly what was going on. It was all very confusing. But I knew that the police were about 3 or 4 feet away from me. That I knew, and they were beating people. So obviously I wanted to protect my camera. And I fell really awkwardly on my arm to try to protect it so it wouldn't break. Because especially with analog cameras, they're like full metal and they're really powerful. But at the same time, if the back had flipped open, the negatives would have been lost. Like it would have been exposed, right?
Right.
So I had to protect that camera when I fell. And then I was like kind of lying on, I kind of twisted away from the cops. I was lying on the ground and I thought, okay, I get it. Away from it. One rear camera. It's a box. It's a box with film in it, and I, you know, my beautiful Nikon, and I threw it up the hill. I just kind of like along the ground, so it wouldn't, you know, get too damaged. Again, I didn't want it to pop open, and I just threw the camera up the hill towards all these people with feet running past me, and I just shouted, "Grab the camera, run!" To anybody who was up ahead, and you know, seriously hoped it wasn't going to be a cop that heard it. And as I did that, turns out that the flash had been dislodged from probably the hit that it took. You know, when I was holding it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the cop hit me across the hand. Anyway, it knocked this big flash that was on the camera off, and the flash went flying to the right as I threw my camera to the left. And the police left the guy they were all jumped on. Like, they, you know, they were all in this huddle on top of this guy. And they all, like, abandoned him, and they all jumped on my flash, which gave me the opportunity to run at that point. And but just before I ran, I was, you know, kind of lying on the ground, looking up ahead after I'd thrown the camera, thinking, oh, my God. I wonder if I'll ever see it again, you know?
Yeah.
And I knew that the most important photographs were in that camera because those were the very last ones where they really started hitting people, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then I saw somebody up ahead, and he was smiling at me, and I was, like, thinking, why are you smiling?
Yeah.
You know, because I didn't think it was a very funny situation. Then I saw him pointing, and he was pointing at my Mickey Mouse strap, camera strap that was on my camera, which was really, you know, it was built from that distance because it was such a ridiculous item, you know, little Mickey Mouse faces. And he was pointing to it. And he didn't show the camera. He showed the strap, right? You know, I recognized it. And I was so happy. So I just scrambled up and I ran for my camera and he handed it back. And then just as he handed it back, Daryl showed up on the bicycle, my savior. And I handed him the camera and he said, I'll meet you at your place. And so he took off with it. And, you know, because I didn't want to be caught, you know, because the police obviously knew who I was. And,
right.
you know, by this point, and, you know, if they had managed to get their hands on me at that point, then I didn't want them to get hands on the camera as well, right? Anyway, so that was good. And made it home safely, and then we took a friend of mine showed up, and we went together to La Presse, and they developed and printed the photographs, and then after that we took it to the English press, we took it to the Gazette.
Right.
And Yeah.
And it was published the next day, right?
Yeah, yeah. They didn't give us front page or anything because obviously we weren't worth that. But we got like fifth page from the press and third page, I think, from the Gazette. And the Gazette had actually hesitated printing them at all because they were saying that they didn't have much room because the Oka crisis was happening.
Right.
And they were saying, you know, it's taking up all their pages. And, the Gazette actually considered not publishing it because they didn't think it was maybe of newsworthy. You can believe that. Right. I was really shocked when they suggested that.
Yeah.
That they weren't, you know, going to print it. So, my friend and I, we were just sort of talking about what had happened, and she mentioned that Station 25 had been one of the major perpetrators of this attack, which was a surprise because Station 25 wasn't from that area. This, you know, we're down in Old Montreal. Station 25 is located up near Concordia. So we decided, I came up with this kind of absurd idea at the time, I suppose. But I had said to her, obviously, Station 25, I mean, if they were there, you know, this was, and we knew it was a homophobic attack. And I said, well, what we should do is we should have 11 in front of Station 25. And that would be, I also knew that, I mean, if we did do this, that would attract media attention. And, you know, I was trying to figure out how to get the Gazette to print these pictures, right? You know, think this story was of value. And so we phoned up one girl and we said to her, hey, if we have a love-in tomorrow in front of Station 25, will you be there? And she said, sure, I'll be there. So on the basis of this, myself, this other person who was with me, and this girl, this unknown girl on the phone, I told the Gazette, oh, by the way, we're having a love-in tomorrow in front of Station 25. And they immediately changed their tune. It was like, oh, well, in that case, there's going to be follow-up. Well, we'll run the story. And they said, you don't even have to organize the media. We'll organize, you know, we'll tell all the rest of the media, you know?
Yeah.
Which was very handy. Because, you know, things like that, of course, didn't take time. So, so anyway, so that was perfect. They went with the story. So that was basically how the loving came about. And then there was the problem that there were only three of us.
I had left Sex Garage because I'd left with two boys and we were going off to have a party somewhere else. And in those days, we did not have email. We didn't have Facebook or social media. We had phone trees. And I got a call, I guess, about early Sunday morning, that there was going to be a demonstration in the village on Sunday night, and I had to be there. And I hadn't been to bed. And I was with my boyfriend at the time, who was a dealer, and he wanted nothing to do with it. And I had participated in the year before, we had the 5th annual AIDS conference in Montreal, when ACT UP New York came to town with activists from Montreal and Toronto and stormed the stage at the opening ceremony. And that changed my life. And to hear what had happened at Sex Garage, I just knew that I had to be there, that I had to participate, that I had to stand up to violence and oppression.
And then by the time I woke up, people had already had protests and been organizing and things like that. And I heard that there was a meeting at Standing, which was a lesbian bar that was on Ontario Street. So I went to, you know, and people were trying to decide what to do next. So I went there, and that was on the Sunday night. And, you know, nobody really knew me at this meeting. You know, I sort of had to sort of stand up and say, well, hello, you know, mm-hmm. I'm the photographer who's shooting it. Probably nobody knew about it yet because the pictures hadn't even come out yet, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't printed yet. And I just said, you know, I'm really, you know, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but I promised the Gazette that we're having a love-in in front of Station 25 tomorrow at noon. You know? And like people were kind of like, some people were kind of saying, well, but we're angry. We don't want to make out, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, once you get there, you can do what you want. You don't have to make out. But the fact is that the Gazette's promised to arrange for all the media to be there, so might as well use it, right? So I went home that night and had no idea if any more than three people were going to show up. And it was the next morning. I woke to a radio interview in French, and I was, you know, quite surprised. But it turns out that the Gazette had actually given my phone number to this radio station, and they asked me to explain in my own words what had happened at Sex Garage. So I went on as best as I could and, you know, described the situation, and I kind of, I suppose, made a little fun of the cops for jumping on my flash, thinking it was my camera. And then I had to leave because we were having the press. And I didn't get to hear the rebuttal by the representative from the police, but I heard it later because somebody had taped it for me. He went on about, I heard what Madame Hamon was said, and, you know, it was on the French, and basically almost called me a liar and came up with some other version of events, which, you know, is more complimentary to the police, I suppose. But I had also said that I did not believe, I said, well, you know, the police will do these things in the dark when there's no witnesses, when they believe there are no witnesses, but they wouldn't dare do this in broad daylight. And like, so they heard say that and decided to prove me wrong, because the love-in turned into something that I really didn't expect.
So we went with our little dime bags and sat in the middle of the village on a Sunday night and watched these young people, men and women, take leadership roles, who were like my sex dates and my drinking buddies. And seeing them take leadership roles was really galvanizing and was really a chapter of growing up, certainly in my life. Mm-hmm. So that was Sunday night. And it had a, like, really festive atmosphere. We're sitting in the village, you know, drag queens were coming out and entertaining and... You know, it was a mix of French, English, and a potpourri of, like, Montreal. Mm-hmm. And the police came and negotiated with some of the people who had taken leadership roles and said that if you disperse these people, we will meet with you tomorrow, Monday, at Station 25. So we dispersed. We went out and partied. People mobilized in those bars, came up with strategies. I think the idea of a kiss-in started happening earlier in the evening for Station 25. And so it was a kiss-in. We were going to do a kiss-in in front of Station 25, which... In my recollection of that time, was very close to the whole building at Concordia.
To experience, you know, for me, because all the media, you know, all the media showed up. We had like every, you know, radio, television, everybody, and you know, and it started off really quite peaceful and happy, and people were making out, and it was almost like a joyous kind of carnival atmosphere. You know, and then it just suddenly all changed, and the police allowed a rumor to circulate about how they were going to take us down, what the strategy they were going to use specific, and people realized that it was about to happen again.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
In broad daylight, right?
Yeah.
And they like about 250 of us there. And we sat down and we, you know, linked arms. And at one point, you know, we started saying, pas de violence, pas de violence. And you know, and it became apparent that no matter what we said or what, you know, the fact that we weren't doing anything violent, they were going to attack us, and they did. They put on these, like, flat jackets, and this time they put on latex gloves to protect their hands, or leather gloves, thinking that probably that we had AIDS. You know, they hadn't done this, by the way, at Saks Garage. There's some rumors to the fact that they'd been wearing latex gloves then, but I think that they, no, they hadn't thought of it until the next day, you know.
Right.
Anyway, and then they took us row by row and started beating us with their clubs, and, you know, and I was in the third row, and it was terrible to be sitting there. And I kind of felt responsible, too, because this had been my... You know, my brilliant idea, that the love-in. You know, I didn't think that the police would respond in a violent manner again,
right.
You know?
Right, yeah.
But they did. Anyway, and then 47 of us got arrested. Mm. I think actually 48 originally, but one of them dropped the charges because his name was Edward Cook. You might have read about him. He had been seen, they had filmed him, TV crews being dragged in by his feet, blowing kisses and being sweet, you know, as he got dragged up the steps to Section 25. And then as soon as they got him in there, they started beating him up. And they also kicked him in the groin, and he almost lost a testicle. And they would not call the ambulance. Like, people were really upset in that Station 25, like in the holding cells, because we knew that he was still there and he was in pain, and they should have called the ambulances, but they kept looking for the journalists and saying, have they gone yet? And they waited for the journalists to leave from the station before they took him away to the hospital.
Well, historically, the relationship between the police and the LGBTQ community was never strong. You know, there were bar raids, regular bar raids, before our generation of the early 90s and the 80s. When they did bar raids and they arrested you, your name would appear in the newspapers. So we were of a generation where we were less intimidated by that kind of provocation. So not good. And, you know, they had raided saunas, and there were fires, and people died. And so not good. It wasn't a healthy relationship. You know, it was always the morality squad. In the 70s, Mayor Doré did a sweep of the city to clean up the gays out of downtown. There's a history of how downtown, the gay village was Peel and St. Catherine back in the day. And that's how the village moved into the east, was because of those sweeps that took place for the Olympics. So the long-winded answer to your question is that relationship with the police was non-existent, violent, and oppressive.
Okay. Yeah, well, you know, I was primarily part of the punk scene, right, in Montreal at that time. But the punk scene also encompassed people that were gay. It seemed like both milieus attracted, people who wanted to express themselves without being judged. Mm-hmm. And within our groups, which overlapped, when one was allowed to do that, right? And the police in the past had actually already given us quite a bit of trouble, like within the punk scene. They had attacked guys in our group who they had been wearing dresses. You know, sometimes they would wear skirts and things like that, right? And they were taken into parking lots and acts And I knew some women that actually being sexually assaulted by the police for doing graffiti. So we didn't really have much trust for the police at that point. As a matter of fact, the friend of mine who witnessed from the other loft space, Bruce Buck, being attacked between the cars, I was surprised when he didn't come forward as an eyewitness, you know, in his defense. And he wouldn't do it, and none of the others would either, because they didn't have any faith that they would receive any justice in Montreal at that point, you know?
Yeah.
Especially being both punk and gay.
Even me, being a rent boy and party boy, I was media savvy. I was certainly interested in, you know, I'd been stripping in New York and fell into the community center and into an ACT UP meeting, and I was like, wow. And I stumbled into the AIDS conference because I saw, like, all these hot guys going somewhere, and I wondered where they were going. And I had my bike, and there were all these tables set up outside of the Montreal Palais des Congrès. So that was 89. So, wow, these people look like me. They sound like me. And they're not taking bullshit. And they're not ashamed of who they are. So I think that was the difference, you know. I wasn't the only person in town that lived that experience. There were queer kids in university taking courses that were cutting edge in the day. So people were more politicized and not afraid to have their names in the newspaper. And then to have a kiss in and then see the cops come out wearing their gloves and batons and, you know, I'm going to say military gear because the name escapes me of what that all that stuff looks like. And then to see people in my community getting beaten up, getting pulled by their hair, getting thrown into paddy wagons, you know. I got, like, pulled away from the girl I was with, and, you know, it's silly. It's silly compared to what was happening to other people during that demo, but dropping my glasses, being dragged away by a cop, and I go to get my glasses, and he steps on them, and I look up, and he's just got this, like, weird smile, like, fuck you, faggot. That's how I interpreted it.
You know, and like I told you earlier, and, we had all our meetings in bars.
Even me. There was a bar on Prince Arthur and Saint-Dominique called Meccano, and we'd use that as our headquarters. And a couple of other bars, and we'd meet, and, you know, all of it was being filmed. We were at the community center in the village. It was, like, near where Priap is, upstairs. And they didn't know what to do with us. The community center didn't want us there. They were like, oh, my God, those Anglo radicals. And we weren't really, because we were a mix. We were a mix. But it was certainly the Anglos who were, like, the most boisterous and the most adamant. And because we had this American concept of ACT UP and Queer Nation, and so we had something to go by. And I think Quebecois deal with things more internally within the system. So, but it was hard for the community center management to kick us out. So that demo happened, and then we organized again, and we did more demos. Things get sketchy for me after that, because I was partying and doing my rent boy thing. And, but I remember sitting in a meeting, and they were organizing a big city demonstration that was going to go by City Hall. And they wanted to organize a party afterwards. And because I'd done Gala de Gilda, this voguing ball at Les Arts on Saint-Denis, because I had done this, they looked to me to organize it. And there was a chap that I've lost touch with, but his name was Spikey. And he and I got together, and then we had this woman called named Suzanne Downs and another woman, and we were kind of the committee to do the outdoor Parc La Fontaine stage event, and we did it, and you know, no one wanted to be associated with gays back then. No one wanted to be associated with, like, diseased pariah. I can only speak for myself as, like, a gay white man. I'm not going to pretend to speak for other communities. I can only speak about my experience. But they could... And then we had... Spikey and I decided that we were going to call the offices of La 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 Human Steps. And perhaps to you that doesn't really mean much, but back in the day, they were like a world-famous dance troupe. And there was a woman in that dance troupe called Louise Le Cavalier, which was like this icon of international dance. Like these bleach blonde dreads. She was like the punk version of Madonna on a stage, and she'd fly through the air. And so we called and we thought, well, why not? And they said yes. And I thought, oh, wow, La 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 is coming. And this was big for us. And I thought, oh, I guess I'll just send a couple of dancers. And we're setting up our stage on the Sunday when we're doing the event. And here comes Louise in all her dreaded bleachness. And we were like, wow, that's really awesome. And, you know, and then we had this alternative rock band that was quite big at the time called Boot Sauce. And their record label didn't want them to perform. And so they changed their name to Toe Jam. There was no way that they weren't going to participate. And then we had a woman that I loved a lot, and I've lost touch with people over the years, but Santana, and she was just like this Latin-infused musician that was just with drums and air instruments. Like trumpets and trombones. It's just extraordinary. And, you know, and seeing people come in marching and coming into the park, and we had a DJ, De La Gautier, who was DJing that, and he's still around Montreal today, DJing, and them coming in and dance music happening and dancing in the park, and this just, like, wild scene of, like, people dancing and dust everywhere and just lost in all of this, like, sun and heat and grass and the type you smoke. And all this dust just gave it, like, this orgiastic sense of community, tribal. And that was my experience of Sex Garage. I had made friends with people who were in ACT UP. I was always kind of like on the fringes. And I had met, when I did this event, Gala de Gilda, with a few friends, I went to this guy who did the show that preceded Queer Core called The Homo Show. His name was David Shannon, and he was one of the leaders. And we're at Meccano, and I'm as high as a kite. And through his work with during Sex Garage, he got hired to do the CBC, had to leave the Homo Show. And we're sitting at the bar, and he says, well, you should take over the Homo Show. What? I don't know how to do radio. I don't know how to do... I think you'd be great. You should do it. So I did, you know, and I was in the throes of a pretty wild drug addiction, and I left my drug dealer boyfriend and still needed to do my drugs. And here I was in a community of, like, young people that were thinking about things and that were exploring issues and that were exploring music, and it threw me into this world that I didn't think I belonged in. And So I stuck around the station, and then I felt that homo show was like too soft, and so we should call it Queercore, and change the name without asking anybody at the station. Just like one day, hi, you're listening to Queercore. And somebody from the programming committee said, Puelo, these things have to be discussed. You can't just... I'm like, oh, well... And I didn't know. And I still don't know. I still do things. And, oh, wow, I didn't know there was a process. Oh, there's a process? That's just my being a lone wolf. And did that. And I think the AIDS conference... And definitely Sex Garage shaped the rest of my life after that, because I owe so much to this radio station, CKUT, and to Queercore. And so I didn't know what the beep I was doing. So I brought in somebody. Well, I shouldn't say brought in, because I don't remember how we connected. But this man who's gone on to be an author, Peter Dubay. And I would produce. I felt very comfortable producing and lining up great interviews. And, you know, I mean, we had Dennis Cooper, and we had Diamanda Galas, and we had Karen Findlay, and we had, like, you know, I would, like, find out the long-distance code when that mattered, and for CKUT, and I'd make all these phone calls, and then they'd be like, whoa, Puelo, what are you doing? Oh, I don't know. You know, it's, and so Sex Garage, that's all due to Sex Garage. So I did this show, Queercore, did it for 3 years. And, then I went to San Francisco Pride through CKUT. It was a campus community radio conference in Vancouver. And a few of us from here went, and we decided that we were going to go stay a couple of weeks in San Francisco during Pride. My first Pride in San Francisco, got picked up by, like, some hot guy on a motorcycle in the parade who just kind of, like, looked at me on a scaffolding and, like, come here, little boy, and I went. And I was like, I couldn't believe that Montreal didn't have Pride. And we had a Pride that was, organized in the village, 100 people. They didn't want drag queens. They didn't want leather people. They didn't want ass bearing. They don't, you know, and I was shocked, because that's what I was like, whoa, well, that's who we are. That's who we are. Why would we want to, like, get rid of that? What's that about? I don't want to be normal. I don't want to fucking be like anybody else. I want to be like what we are. So I went to San Francisco Pride, learned a lot, and then I went to the March on Washington in 93, and that cemented my desire to have a Pride parade in Montreal. And came back and hooked up with John Custodio, and John Custodio wrote this manifesto, and we did like a co-op. There was a co-op at that time of like a few people from Concordia, and, you know, we wrote a manifesto for this, for what became Diversité. And we did our first parade. No one in town believed that it could happen. People were taking bets about how many people would show up. That set the precedent for Diversité. Diversité changed a lot of things.
In 2007, Diversité repositioned itself as a general arts and culture festival, no longer holding a parade. In response, Fierté Montréal began organizing one, and in the same year, Perversité formed as a result of a small workshop about queers and anarchism held at the Anarchist Book Fair. Since then, we have become an annual, collaboratively organized Pride festival that seeks to provide a critical and accessible series of events aimed to bring back the radical underpinnings to Pride festivals. Our festival began last week on Thursday, August 6th, and will continue until August 15th, this Saturday. You can check out more about our programming on perversité.org. A number of Linda Dawn Hammond's photos, including some never before seen by the public, can be seen at an exhibition being held outside at Place Émilie Gamelin, August 12th through 15th, as well as a love-in that is planned for this Sunday, August 16th, with the meeting place and time to be announced. We'll share the event on our Facebook page. Until next week, this has been another edition of QueerCore on CKUT 90.3 FM. Don't touch that dial.
Just a prisoner made, no escape. fresh breath of alternate air.
This record!